So, welcome everybody, and to the people online, we're starting a retreat this evening, or tomorrow morning, however you put it, a week-long retreat on Tara. So I'm just going to make a few comments about that, because I always call retreat a time of taking vacation with the Buddha. And so, you know, taking a week out to go on vacation with Tara is really nice, because Tara is a very nice person to be with. Yeah. She doesn't insult you. She doesn't pick at your faults. But the problem is, then you can't pick at her faults either, because she's a Buddha. So, what it means is that everything that comes up in our meditation, we're responsible for, and we can't blame it on the Dharma or on the Buddha or on Tara or anything else. But it's a wonderful opportunity to have some, time apart from our usual hectic lives to really look inside and develop our good qualities. So tomorrow we'll get into the Tara Sadhana, and I'll give some explanation on that, and then also on the eight dangers that come with the Tara practice, which I always like to talk about because they're so juicy. Yeah. But tonight, what we're doing is a continuation of a series of talks I've been giving for over a year now on the Gomchen Lamrim. And we're at the section in the Lamrim on the Bodhisattva precepts. And so I've been talking about the auxiliary Bodhisattva precepts. And even though some of you haven't heard, don't have these precepts, or you haven't heard the previous year's teachings, which are all online, by the way, if you want to follow them. I think it's that what we're being talking about tonight will be completely understandable and will be helpful to you, even if you haven't listened to everything that's come before. So last time we finished the precepts in accord with the perfection of fortitude, right? Yeah, so we're starting the ones about the perfection of joyous effort, right? Okay, so these are the, in the auxiliary bodhisattva precepts, they're divided according to the six perfections, and the precepts are to abandon certain activities that prevent us from generating these six perfections: generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stability, and wisdom. And so we're on the fourth one, the joyous effort. So there's three precepts here. So it starts with number 22 of the auxiliary precepts. So these are things to abandon. Gathering a circle of friends or disciples because of your desire for respect or profit. Okay, so joyous effort is taking delight in creating virtue. But if we do what looks like virtue, such as gathering a circle of friends or disciples, but our motivation is crooked, meaning that we want to gather people because we want respect or profit, then it's really interfering with our Dharma practice. So this precept is specifically against the tendency to become proud or arrogant because of having students or because of knowing the Dharma, such that people will become impressed with you and like you and follow you around, and you have a whole circle of groupies. Okay, so I mean, that's a really blatant illustration, you know, somebody who just wants a circle of groupies, little puppies following them around saying, "You're a Buddha, you're a Buddha," you know. And you see examples of this, yeah. And not that everybody who's a teacher who has the kind of disciples has a bad motivation, but some of them are definitely looking, you know, because if you have a group of people who regard you as a teacher, then you get some status. Then, of course, you're hoping all the students that look at you as a teacher will tell other people how wonderful you are. You know, "Oh, so-and-so is such a good teacher. I went to the retreat, this course that they led. There's this, 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 this." And they tell all their friends. And then, of course, you become more well-known. And you begin to think that you're somebody. Yeah? And that mind that begins to think that we're somebody important in the Dharma world, that, you know, we have some special ability to be a teacher, that mind becomes a big hindrance to practice. Yeah? Because if we're a big shot, then we don't think we can learn much from anybody else. Yeah, because we're already so knowledgeable. So why should I go to this person's teachings or that person's teachings? Because anyway, you know, I know just as much as them, or I'm as highly ranked as them. Whether we are or not doesn't matter, but we think we are. And so that inhibits our ability to learn from other people. And it completely distorts our Dharma motivation, such that our Dharma practice becomes the 8 worldly concerns. Yeah, so that instead of creating virtue, we're just doing the 8 worldly concerns, seeking reputation. Or also, when it says profit, it means offerings. Okay, so if you're teaching or giving talks, then people not only respect you and talk about you, how wonderful you are, blah, 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 and you begin to get, "Look at what I have and who I am, and look at all these emails they send me, how adoring they are. Look at the cards they send me saying how much they benefited from my talks and retreats, and we have them all around, and we're like, you know, we're pretty good, aren't we?" Yeah, almost as good as our own teachers. Yeah. If you start thinking that, then you're really in trouble. And plus, then all these people who think that we're so wonderful, then they give us gifts. So they make dana offerings, monetary offerings. They give us food. They give us socks. They give us... When you're a monastic, you need socks. Yeah? They give you shoes, too. And then you become a little bit uppity and you tell them what kind of shoes you want. You know, "I don't want those shoes. I want brand shoes, you know. Or I want boots, my winter boots, or, you know, junky. I want really nice winter boots." And, you know, and so you start collecting, you know, the people want to give you things. Yeah. They want to give you maybe a Rolex watch. "Oh, look. This is why at the Abbey we don't wear watches, okay? Because in the Tibetan community, many people wear watches as jewelry, and it impresses people if you have a very nice gold, especially Rolex watch, you know? That is a status symbol in the Tibetan community. And certain kind of shoes, you know, I don't want to call them gym shoes, but you know the kind of shoes that everybody wears, you know, with the different colors and the thick, so yeah, those are a big status symbol. And then certain kind of backpacks, yeah, not crummy backpacks that you've been using for 15 years, but new backpacks with lots of pockets that are kind of jazzy, okay? So those are status symbols. Yeah. And so, you know, your benefactors or your students or whoever it is give you those things. And then, of course, that increases your status and, you know, like that. So that kind of, you know, mind is not a Dharma mind, and it's completely deceptive. It not only cheats the students, but it cheats us. Because, like I said, if we think we're already such hot stuff, then we can't learn from anybody. Yeah, the Tibetans have a saying that the lush meadows grow at the bottom of the valley, not at the top of the mountain. Yeah, top of the mountain is barren, jagged rock. Okay. So we should always try and have a good motivation when we, you know, are teaching or giving talks or whatever. Okay, then number 22 is not dispelling the three types of laziness. Yeah, so three types of laziness. First one, sloth. Second one, attraction to distracting activities. And third one is self-pity and discouragement. Okay, so let's look at those and see why they interrupt our joyous effort, which means taking delight in virtue. Yeah. So sloth. Yeah. I'm really tired. I can't meditate now. I'm tired. I'll do it later. You know, I was up last night talking to my friends. No, so I overslept this morning, no time to practice. Or tonight there's a really good show, you know, on TV, so no time to practice. But anyway, I've worked hard all week on the weekend, so I think I'll just take it easy and relax. And, you know, I know on Monday I had set out a whole thing Dharma study I was going to do on the weekend, but, you know, that was Monday. Now it's Friday. I'm tired. Yeah, I'm sleep deprived. Okay, so you know that mind? Yeah, it's a very convincing one for why we can't study and practice. Yeah, I'm so tired. I've worked so hard. Okay, so there's that one. Second one is being extremely busy with worldly activities, or as it's put here, attraction to distracting activities. So this one actually in society makes you fantastic. Yeah, this makes you the excellent worker that everybody wants to have, because you are driven to overwork to, you know, to complete the project, to, you know, get it done and be the leader. And, you know, and then after you've done that to, you know, you have your hobbies. And so you've got to excel at your hobbies. And you have to go to all the latest movies because everybody in the office is talking about the latest movies. So you have to go to them. Otherwise, who are you going to be, you know, if you don't watch all the latest movies on the, you know, on, what is it? I don't even know where you watch it. Used to be the cinemas, but now I guess you can do it at home on your computer. And yeah, so we are the busiest of the busy. We always have appointments. Our schedule is full. Yeah. It's called getting a life. As when you aren't busy all the time, people say, why don't you get a life? Yeah, meaning that we should, you know, be doing lots of things to write up a lot of stuff on our Facebook page so that we have a good image and, you know, we're the busiest of the busy doing samsaric activities that don't help our Dharma practice at all, but are basically distractions from creating virtue. Yeah? So all these worldly activities are the things that worldly people will compliment you on and praise you about. Yeah? Oh, you work at this company and you got a promotion, and you know it was because you worked, 12-hour days and you got the promotion, and that everybody's envious because you're doing so well at your job, and then plus you know all the movies and you're working out at the gym and you're going here and all these exotic vacations. You are the model of somebody who is with it. Yeah? You know what I mean? So we all have our own version of that, depending on, your surroundings and who you want to impress and what activities you like to do. So one person is traveling all the time with their work, and another person is growing bonsai plants, and another person is knitting, and another person is bowling. And, we all have our own thing that we want to be best at, and project this good image. So we're the people. Yeah, you know how it is? You go out you make appointments to see your friends. And the first thing that happens when you go to the restaurant to see your friends is everybody takes out their smartphone and puts it on the table. Isn't it? Yeah? Everybody has their smartphone on the table. And you check your smartphone. And, if you have a lot of things coming in on your smartphone that, take you away from the conversation with the friends, then, you're somebody who's really important. Look at all those people who are texting you. Half of them are, wanting to sell you something. But never mind, you take the call, you take the text anyway. Yeah? And then, meanwhile, you're with your friends, then you're doing this to make appointments to be with other friends. And then when you're with your other friends, then you also take out your smartphone and put it on the table and look at it a lot and text other people to make appointments to be with them. Crazy, isn't it? Yeah. And then, we feel like, wow, I'm so popular. I'm doing something. I have all these appointments. I'm so busy. That's the whole thing. Why aren't you practicing Dharma? Why can't you go to retreat? Why can't you go to teachings? Yeah. Why can't you read a book? Why can't you have a daily meditation practice? Because I'm so busy. And that's saying I'm busy means don't ask me any more questions. Yeah. Don't ask me what I'm busy doing. Yeah. Because then I might have to tell you that I'm actually just lying around doing nothing or folding the laundry or whatever. Yeah. But I'm busy is the ultimate reason or excuse why you can't do Dharma. Isn't it? You're all kind of looking at me. How about Singaporean friends on the other end of the line there? Too busy? Yeah. We're always too busy, aren't we? But what are we doing that makes us too busy? Things that are usually worldly activities. So many things we have to do. Especially, it's June, so there's weddings. Yeah. So you got to go to all the weddings. Huh? And then a few months later, you go to all the baby showers. Anyway, you got the idea. Then the third one. Okay, the three things that are the three types of laziness. First one was sloth. Second one was being busy doing worldly activities. Third one is self-pity and discouragement. So this is, I have to visualize White Tara. Come on, White Tara, come on. Where are you? you know, I can't do it. I'm trying to visualize. And she's just not coming. You know, maybe she went on vacation with somebody else, not with me. You know, and I just can't visualize. Anyway, you know, I'm hopeless. I just can't visualize. It's not my way. But if I say, what kind of pizza do you like? Do you have a visualization of the kind of pizza you like best? Yeah? You have that visualization like that, don't you? If I say, think of the person that you're romantically attracted to. Boing! They're in your mind. Perfect visualization. Yeah? Okay? So we can visualize. We just can't visualize the Buddha very well. Why? Because of habit. We're much more familiar with objects of romance or people that we're attached to. It could be our mother or our children or, you know, our pets as well. You know, we can visualize all of them very easily because of habit. Pizza? Good habit. Instant visualization. Okay? So we can visualize, but we just have to create a new habit to visualize the Buddha. Or, you know, any other thing that we use to discourage ourselves in the practice. You know, enlightenment, caring about all sentient beings more than myself. Forget it. I can't do that. Anyway, I don't want to care about more sentient beings, other sentient beings more than myself. Because if I do, then I'll suffer. I don't want to suffer. So let them go to some other person who's a Buddha. Yeah, I can't become a Buddha. You know, Buddhas have to give their body for the benefit of sentient beings. I don't want to give my body to anybody. Yeah, so the goal's too high, the path is too difficult, and anyway, I'm incapable. Okay, so the whole thing of putting ourselves down. Like, oh, okay, I know I have a problem with attachment. I know I have a problem with ignorance, with anger. But I really can't do anything. You know, I'm just attached to that person or those people. I'm just attached. That's the way it is. I can't do anything about it. Anyway, they want me to be attached to them, and I want to be attached to them. Yeah? What's wrong with being attached anyway? Why do Buddhists say attachment's a hindrance? I think attachment's great. It makes me feel good. Except when I don't get along with that person. But never mind that. Okay. Or anger, you know? I just have a temper, that's all. You just gotta learn to deal with it. I can't do anything about it. My parents are like that. My grandparents are like that. We're all hot-headed. So don't ask me to change. Okay? So this whole thing of discouraging ourselves, telling ourselves we can't change before we've even started. Yeah? Or the self-pity mind. Yeah? Oh. I tried to meditate on the antidote to anger, but nobody loves me. They don't love me, so I'm angry at them and I feel left out. All the people I'm attached to, they don't reciprocate it. Everybody else has so many friends, but I don't. They all pick on me. Ever since I was in kindergarten, even before that, I was the kid that got bullied. I was the kid who wasn't in the popular group. And it's still now. The Dharma Center, nobody loves me either. You know. I'm sure they say Buddha loves everybody, but I don't think he loves me because I'm just a lovable. Okay. So, yeah. So the mind of self-pity and discouragement is, you know, that is not humility. Okay. We confuse humility with discouragement and self-pity. Yeah. Actually, self-pity and discouragement are a form of arrogance. Yeah. Because I'm special. I'm the worst one. I'm the most incapable one. Okay? It's actually a form of arrogance. Okay? So, with all of these, you can see how all these three kinds of lazinesses, three kinds of laziness, okay? We can develop identities that are attached to them. The first one of, well, actually, the one from the previous precept, I'm this great teacher who gives wonderful talks, who has all these people who love them and say I'm wonderful. Or, I'm the person who, you know, I just sleep a lot. That's it. Yeah. I'm the person who's the busiest of the busy because I have so many important worldly things to do that make me successful. Or, I'm the person who's totally incapable. I can't visualize white Tara. I can't visualize purple Tara. I can't. I can only visualize pizza. You know, Tara sitting on an open lotus flower, difficult. Tara sitting on a pizza, possible. Okay. What? Why were you visualizing that? Yeah. On an open lotus flower, you know, on top of which is a pizza with mushroom and extra cheese. Yeah. On top of that sits Tara, radiant. Yeah, then maybe we can get it. There's Tara, a right hand in the gesture of generosity, giving hot fudge sundaes. The left hand in the mudra of refuge, you know, the two fingers are what are the two fingers? They're Google and Bing. and the three fingers upwards are my phone, my smartphone, my tablet, and my computer. Yeah. Oh yeah, right, okay. Well, she has eyes in the palms of her hands and in her feet and three eyes on her face. So she's able to look at Instagram and Tumblr and all those at the same time. Okay. So anyway, we develop whole identities based on these things. And then it becomes a huge obstacle to our Dharma practice. Okay? Because then instead of having enthusiasm for virtue and feeling delighted and happy and rejoicing when we create virtue, we just, again, shoot ourselves in the foot and we don't even try. Yeah, which is a great loss because it takes a lot of good karma to have a precious human life. It's very rare and difficult to have this opportunity, and then to have this opportunity and waste it is really a tragedy. Yeah. So joyous effort is very important. Okay, then we move on to the to eliminate the obstacles to the perfection of meditative stability. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, I skipped that one. What is that one? This also is with joyous effort. With attachment, spending time idly talking and joking. Good thing I skipped it. Shall we go on? Yeah? How much time do we spend idly talking and joking and just messing around and playing around and like that? Yeah? Not really doing anything meaningful. This doesn't mean that all of our conversations with people have to be deep, intense Dharma discussions. Yeah, that certainly won't work. But, you know, if we're just spending a lot of time, just, you know, I like to chat because, you know, when I chat, I can tell really good stories and I can tell jokes and I monopolize the conversation. And, you know, I've been at the Abbey the longest, so I know all the ins and outs and I can tell you everything about the Abbey, so I can dominate the conversation. You know, whatever it is. And, you know, just spending a lot of time liking to hear ourselves talk. Hmm? Or, you know, we say talk. That's because they didn't have texting and Facebook and all that kind of stuff at the time of the Buddha. Okay, so this, you know, this really interferes because we spend so much time. Yeah. I've got to read the latest stupidaggio from our president. Yeah. So, okay, now we'll go on to meditative stability. Yeah. So there's 1, 2, 3 precepts there. Okay. So the first one is not seeking the means to develop concentration, such as proper instructions and the right conditions necessary to do so, and not practicing the instructions once you have received them. So here we transgress this due to lethargy. You know, we don't feel like it. We're too tired. Yeah. Or pride. I know it already. I don't need to seek instructions on concentration. I know how to develop concentration already. Okay? So as an effect of, you know, either of those minds, of lethargy or of arrogance, then we don't seek out the instructions. So we don't go to teachings to learn how to concentrate. And instead, we consider ourselves expert meditators and that we're just going to sit down and develop concentration all by ourselves. You know, or maybe we've heard a little bit of teaching on it and we think, well, that's enough and I'll be able to develop samadhi with that little bit of teaching. Or we receive teachings, but then when we sit down to meditate, we don't practice them because we're really enjoying our distractions a lot. Yeah. You know how you sit down to meditate and you... Yeah, there's white Tara, and then, oh, white Tara reminds me of a friend that I had. And this, and then my friend and I, we used to go to the beach every summer. That was really nice. And lotuses, that reminds me of my trip when I went to Burma. Okay, so we do a lot of meditation on everything that has to do with me. Okay, so... So the thing to do here is that we should receive teachings on how to develop concentration, and we should try and practice them. And if we are intent on developing serenity or shamatha, then we definitely need to seek the right conditions to do so. Yeah, they say if you don't have all the right conditions, then your efforts won't bring you all the way to serenity. You may, you know, increase your concentration somewhat, but to actually go through the 9 stages that that culminate in serenity, we need special conditions. For example, we need to be in a very quiet place without a lot of sound, so not with highways, not with, kids and television and neighbors and, our phone buzzing or beeping or, what do you call it? Yeah, vibrating. So you need to have very good ethical conduct. You need to learn to be content, okay? And to be easily satisfied. And that's really difficult. Yeah. So if we're going to do, retreat, and with the intention of developing serenity, we really should try and develop, to choose a place that has these qualities and train ourselves beforehand so that we're easily contented, easily satisfied, have good ethical conduct, so that we're not disturbed by a lot of regret and remorse, so that we don't break a lot of precepts and so on. Lots of times when people start the Dharma, they really want to focus on developing serenity as a main thing. And that's a wonderful, aspiration to do. My teachers have always encouraged us first to get a good overview of the path, how the path works, how it functions, and to develop experience in the mind training and in the ability to restrain ourselves from unethical actions, the ability to restrain ourselves from following attachment and anger and all the other afflictions. Because if we don't have some familiarity with the antidote to the afflictions, then when we sit down to meditate, they just overwhelm our mind and we don't know what to do. Whereas if we've practiced the thought training teachings and the Lam Rim teachings, then when we're trying to meditate to develop concentration, if attachment and clinging comes up, we know, okay, I have to meditate on impermanence and the disadvantages of cyclic existence. Yeah. If anger comes up, we know we have to meditate on fortitude and on loving kindness. Yeah. So we know the antidotes and are able to apply them so that we can return to the object of our concentration, the object of our meditation. If we aren't familiar with the antidotes, then, we just have one affliction after the other and it becomes very difficult to develop, concentration. Okay? So I'm not saying don't try. I'm saying, especially if you're, you have work and family and you're active, just to accept that you can develop, you can improve your concentration, but it's going to be difficult to develop full serenity within the external conditions in which you live, or if you lack the kind of prerequisite training and knowing the instructions and so on. And, from my experience in talking with people who have done retreats, long retreats on serenity, some people are quite successful, and some people, they may be successful in generating some concentration, but they don't really have the Buddhist worldview. And so after their retreat, what they choose to do, indicates to me that maybe they didn't understand, they didn't really have the Buddhist worldview and understand the path to awakening. I always think that as much preparation as we can have, the better, in everything we do. That makes some sense to people? So practice serenity and shamatha as much as you can, but be realistic and really try, you know, because if you have a good understanding of what samsara is and how disadvantageous it is, and you have an understanding of what the path is, what's needed to attain liberation and awakening, then all your practice is geared towards your ultimate spiritual aim, and you're not going to get sidetracked by different experiences that you may have in meditation. And you'll also be able to deal with all the things that come up when you are trying to develop serenity, you know, because when you're really doing intense retreat on that, all sorts of stuff comes up. One of my friends did a 3-year retreat, and some of you may have been here when she came to EML, and she was telling us about her experience. And she said, everything you've ever done in your life comes up in the retreat. Yeah. And, you know, and you find yourself, you are chanting the commercial jingles that you heard when you were a kid, you know. And she, I remember specifically, she said, and there you are, you know, trying to meditate, and you're all of a sudden out of seemingly nowhere, the answer marching one by one, you know, comes in your mind or whatever it is, you know. So all that kind of distraction comes in, and also all sorts of previous experiences that you've had. So if you have, you know, things that you haven't worked out psychologically, those things are going to come up in the middle of your retreat, and you're going to have to work with them. So I think the more we can prepare for that kind of retreat, then the easier the retreat's going to be. Whereas if we have very little preparation and we don't have the right circumstances, then not much will change. Yeah, I heard the story. One friend was talking with one Tibetan Lama, and another student came in who had just finished a 3-year retreat and started talking about what they had done and meditation in the 3-year retreat and everything, this and that and the other thing. And then when that person left, the Lama made some remark to the effect of 3 years of meditation, but the mind is still the same. Yeah, which is sad. Which is sad. Okay, so yeah, the more preparation we have, the better. So this is a way to encourage you in your daily practice. Because how do you get that preparation? Through having a consistent daily practice and being very patient, because it takes a long time to work on our mind. Or it takes a long time not to overcome bad habits. That's the way I should put it. Old habits, we're not going to get rid of them by Tuesday. Yeah, maybe Wednesday. Yeah. 50 years plus Wednesday. Okay. Or 50 lifetimes plus Wednesday. Okay. So it's always better to have really a long-term vision in our practice instead of one that is looking for quick, jazzy results. So that, like I said, that's not meant to discourage you. It's meant to encourage you in terms of making proper preparation. It's kind of like, you know, if you're going to go to the DMV and take a driver's test, you better practice driving beforehand. Yeah? Don't go in thinking, oh, I've watched other people drive. I know how to drive. Yeah, because that's not going to work at the DMV. Yeah, as you knock into the other cars around, and then they ask you to parallel park. Oh. Okay, then 25. Not abandoning the five hindrances to meditative stabilization: sensual desire, malice, lethargy and sleep, restlessness and regret, and doubt. Okay, so there are different sets of five hindrances. There's another set when you're talking about Maitreya's teachings on how to develop shamatha. These five are the ones that are found in the suttas, that the sutras that are common in the Pali and Sanskrit traditions. Okay, so sensual desire. And I'll talk a little bit about these because we're starting a meditation retreat. So we're going to encounter these. Yeah, sensual desire. We are beings in the desire realm. We love to see beautiful things and hear beautiful sounds and smell nice things and taste good food and have nice, pleasant physical sensations. Okay? So we have a lot of sensual desire. And you're meditating, lunch comes up. Yeah? And you're wondering, what is for lunch? Yeah. Your boyfriend or girlfriend come up. Yeah. Your new sports equipment comes up. Your children and your parents come up. Yeah. We fill with desire. Yeah. We want things. Yeah. We want, you're thinking of the boat that you want to buy and or the Caribbean cruise that you want to go on or the rock climbing you want to do or whatever your thing is. Okay? We're filled with desire for new exciting experiences and sensual sensations. Okay? So this comes up in meditation, doesn't it? Yeah, it's right there. Yeah, you're no exception. When this stuff comes up, don't think everybody else in the room has samadhi and you're the only one thinking about sex and food and money and rock and roll. Everybody's doing it. Okay. Maybe not at the exact same moments as you are, but at some time or another in the retreat, this is going on, okay? So we're all dealing with the same stuff. So, what do we do when sensual desire comes up in our mind? What's the antidote? Yeah, one of the antidotes is to think about the ugliness of the object. Okay, so you're sitting there having sexual fantasies and you dissect the body, mentally dissect, please. Not actually, mentally dissect the body of the person that you're lusting after. Peel away their skin. What's under their skin? Take out their eyeballs and put them on the table. Okay, and their ears. And then take their hair and spread it out. And those, what is it? Your eyes are like diamonds and your teeth are like pearls. Take all their teeth, pearly teeth. What's so beautiful about their teeth and their skin and what's under the skin? Yeah. If that doesn't cure your desire, yeah. Okay. So we look at the ugliness of the object, or we look at the disadvantages of attachment to that object. Yeah, where is the attachment going to take me? I'm dreaming about a new improved paycheck, yeah, with more money coming in and what I'm going to do with it. And the promotion that I'm going to get so that I can get that new paycheck or whatever it is. And then you think, well, okay, is that only going to bring advantages? Or what's going to happen? Yeah, what's going to happen if I have that paycheck and I get all those possessions? Okay. Well, the more possessions you have, the more suffering you have when they break. Yeah, remember before you had a computer, you never suffered from computer hell. Now we suffer from computer hell because our computer breaks. And you know how it deletes the files, the most important one that you need that day? That it just deletes for who knows what reason. Okay. Yeah. Once you have a car, then you have car hell. Because your car breaks down, then you have to pay money to get it fixed. It always breaks down when it's inconvenient. Because anyway, there's no convenient times for your car to break. So, yeah, and your car is going to break. As soon as you have a car, guaranteed it's going to break. Our chipper caught on fire. As soon as you have a chipper, you know you're going to have a chipper that broke. That's going to break. Yeah, we had to replace our hot water heaters. As soon as you have hot water, you know you're going to have hot water that doesn't work. Okay, so the more you have, the more problems you're going to have. And then you also have the privilege of working more hours and becoming more exhausted to make more money to buy all those things. And then you really have problems. Because you get the latest thing. Yeah, you get the latest smartphone, and then they release a new one in another year, and your phone is obsolete. And all your friends have the new phone, and you have the old phone. Okay? So, you know, just think about the difficulties. You know, we dream of having this beautiful house. We had some college students come up a few weeks ago. And during lunch, yeah, they were saying how, you know, one of the guys in the couple was saying he really wanted to get a good job and make a lot of money. And I said, why? And, you know, his wife says, oh, so we can live in a nice house. And I said, really? You want to live in a nice house? I mean, because there's all sorts of problems you have when you live in a nice house. Because like I said, the more things you have, the more things are going to break. And then, of course, if you have a really nice house in a really nice neighborhood, you need a burglar alarm. Okay? What's going to happen when you have a burglar alarm? It's going to go off. At times when you don't want it to go off. Like when I stay in your house and I get up early and open the front door, not realizing that you have a burglar alarm. And then suddenly, rawr, rawr. Okay. Or when your kids open a window in the middle of the night and it sets off the burglar alarm. Or when the burglar alarm just feels like going off anyway. Yeah, they have their own personalities. Okay, so, you know, you just think a little bit about this stuff, and it really helps to lessen the desire. When we're wanting status, when we're wanting praise and a good reputation, when we're wanting people to approve of us, what I find works very well is to ask myself, what good is that going to do me? Okay, I get new social status. You know, how is that going to advance the things that are really meaningful for me in my life? Yeah, okay, I get praise and I get fame and I get more social status. Okay, so that means that I get a better obituary when I die. Yeah. How is that better obituary going to benefit me? I'm already going to be born in another realm. Okay. I'll be more famous. More people will come to my funeral. I have a better, bigger funeral than you have. Well, who cares when you're in a lower realm what size funeral you had from your previous life? And how is anybody's praise ever really going to be meaningful to us? Yeah, we say, well, but when people approve of me and praise me, then I feel good about myself. But then that's a setup, because then when they criticize us and disapprove of what we're doing, then we feel awful about ourselves. Yeah, what good is somebody's praise going to do us? I mean, you think you want to be famous, and then it's a hassle. I mean, look at the people who are famous now. And they get written about. I mean, their whole private lives are public. Yeah. And every little thing about their lives is printed in the media and dissected in the media. I wouldn't want to have that kind of fame. Yeah. They say if you're a bodhisattva that being famous can be good, because then you can, more people might come to your teachings and you can influence people. But I think you really have to be a highly developed bodhisattva to endure a lot of fame. Really. I mean, I look at His Holiness. He can't just go outside where He lives and walk down the street. Yeah, the really famous high lamas, they can't just go walk down the street. Everybody knows them and comes and wants a blessing. And also they're trapped by this whole social code of status of high lamas. And so who must go visit who? Yeah. So if you're a very high lama, you don't go visit the lower lamas. They have to come and visit you. Yeah, there's this whole social thing. So, you know, sometimes it can be a real, you can't just be an ordinary, anonymous person, but all of a sudden, everywhere you're put in a role due to the fame. I think it's quite burdensome. Yeah, I think of, you know, like Ivanka Trump and her husband, you know, and they get so much publicity and so much fame, and you look at them and they are the epitome of what every American wants to be. Rich, famous, gorgeous, young, rich, they have kids, they have fame, they have power, they have everything. Yeah. I wouldn't want to be them. Not for $1 million, or even 2 million, or 5 million, you know? I would not want to look like Ivanka Trump. To me, she looks very plastic. Everything is so perfect about the way she looks that she looks like a plastic doll. You know? And then every picture that people take of you, you have to be perfectly posed, you know, in exactly the same, the perfect way to give forth the image of that, you know? No, thank you. I mean, you get trapped by all of that. It's a complete prison, total prison. So, yeah. So when you want to be famous, then really think about what famous people have to go through. Because also, if you're famous, everybody's going to criticize you. Yeah, as soon as you have power and fame, yeah, what do you have? Criticism. So, you know, sometimes, I mean, if you really want to practice the Dharma, being an ordinary person, innocuous person, makes it much easier. Much easier. Yeah. Okay, sensual desire, malice. So sensual desire, think about the disadvantages of the thing. Think about the ugly aspect. Yeah. Think think about, if I got this, what good would it really do me? Yeah, then we usually realize it wouldn't do me any good. Okay, then malice is the next one. So malice or ill will. Yeah, somebody hurt us, somebody harmed us, they cheated us, they deceived us, they betrayed our trust, and we want revenge. Okay, so of course we're much too cultured and polite to say we want to hurt somebody and make them suffer. But that's our intention. You know, those ill will in the mind. Somebody hurt me, and I want to hurt him back for their benefit. So they'll have a taste of their own medicine. So they'll know how I feel, and they'll come crawling on their hands and knees to apologize to me. Forget it. Okay. So malice, extremely painful. Yeah. You know, if you're trying to meditate, you can see why it's an obstruction to gaining concentration. Yeah, because all you're doing is meditating on how much you hate somebody, how much you want to cause harm to them, how much you're jealous of them. Okay. Very unhappy mind. Very, very unhappy mind. Okay, so the antidote to that is fortitude, in case somebody has harmed you, to learn to endure suffering without taking it personally, and also developing loving kindness and compassion for the people, so that instead of having ill will and malice, you have a kind attitude towards them. Yeah. And if you can spend some time meditating on kindness every day, then it really transforms your relationships, because how you see people changes. Yeah. So actually, I was going to say that, you know, we have a retreat for the next week. So every day, in some of the time when you're doing silent meditation, then contemplate the kindness of others. Yeah, not just the kindness of the people you're attached to. That's easy. And that's not helpful, because then you just get more attached to them. Yeah. But think of the kindness of the people who have helped you that you're not attached to. Maybe different mentors or people who are good role models or examples for you, people who tutored you. And then from there, go on to strangers, the people who make the roads and grow the food and make your clothes and, you know, all these kinds of things that enable us to survive in the world. And then when you get really good at that, then also go on to think about the kindness of the people who have harmed you, and how by harming you, they've woken you up out of your complacent stupor and given you some, pointed out to you your afflictions and your need to work on certain qualities, you know, certain aspects of yourself. Yeah, because without the people who say things that we don't like, we would never see our faults, and so we would never change. So the people were always saying, I want to improve, I want to improve. Yeah, so somebody's telling us how to improve. Yeah, don't pay attention to the tone of their voice. Don't pay attention to the vocabulary. Pay attention to what they're telling you and see if it's true or not. And, you know, if it's true, then work on that aspect of yourself, because you'll be happier if you do. Okay? Okay, let's pause here. There's still three more to go, but I want to give you a chance for some questions and comments and so on.
Can you say a little bit about how the 21st one relates to joyous effort?
How the one about gathering a circle of friends or disciples because of your desire for respect or profit, how that relates to joyous effort? Because you're not, it looks like you're creating virtue, but you're not, because your motivation's completely corrupt. So there's no delight in virtue. There's just delight in the eight worldly concerns. Okay? And so you spend your time, you know, with this corrupt motivation, looking like you're practicing Dharma, but there's no delight in virtue.
Just following on from Losong's question, I also think, and it's something I have to pay attention, I think, for myself too, but how easy it would be not to know that you have that wrong motivation. That's the part of the problem.
Yeah.
You think you're doing great because you're measuring the success of your practice by the external situation,
exactly,
not by what's happening internally. So it'd be really easy to be seduced by that internally for a long time.
Long time. Yep. That's why people who criticize us are some of the people who are kindest to us. Because if we're stuck in that, the person who points out our phony baloney is helping us tremendously. Yeah, because we're not even aware that we're doing it.
How do you know when you're ready to do a serenity retreat? Will your teacher tell you, or, you know, if you've been practicing for a certain number of years, or just comes up?
Okay, well, there's this chart, and if you'd practice for 4 point years and 3 months and 2 days, now it's going to be really individual, because people have different dispositions, different interests, different inclinations. So it's going to be something that, from your side, you're very interested in doing, and you've done preparation, and from your teacher's side, they think that you've done the sufficient preparation and have the right external conditions to be able to do the retreat. And I would add, too, that, you know, that they know that if you develop serenity, you won't get, you know, that you'll use it properly to continue to advance on the path, and won't just say, seek serenity as, this is the end point. Once I get this, then I'm satisfied. Because that's not liberation.
Venerable Children, you mentioned that sometimes you can see that people have done some concentration retreat, and they've sort of, there's some kind of signs you can see that they haven't really gone in the direction that the meditation would hopefully lead them to.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of those indicators?
Some of those indicators? They complain. They get angry a lot. They're very dissatisfied. You know, want more and better. A lot of doubt in their practice. Yeah, not a lot of conviction in the practice. Or, you know, a lot of enchantment with being, you know, having a good reputation, that kind of attachment too.
Why is serenity not liberation? Because it sounds pretty good.
Okay, so why is serenity, or the high, serenity actually, when it comes to all the levels of concentration, it's just the first one. Then after serenity, there's the four dhyanas, or the four jhanas, as they say, and then above them, the four formless meditative absorptions. So why aren't they liberation, even though they sound really peaceful? Because first of all, they haven't eliminated the afflictions from the root. Yeah. What's happened is, due to the power of the concentration, the coarse afflictions have temporarily been suppressed so that they don't come up and interrupt your meditation, so you can stay in concentration single-pointedly for a long time. But so those afflictions have been suppressed, the coarse ones, but they have not been uprooted. So, when the karma to be in that kind of state is consumed, then you're back to where you were before. Okay? Because the afflictions have not been completely forever removed. Yeah. What would be a good example? Yeah, that's a good example. Yeah. Yeah, you have knapweed, so you just pick off the flower at the top, or you just step on it and crush it. Or you pull it, but you don't get the root. So it's going to come back again. Okay, when the right circumstances are there. Okay, so your wisdom, just because you have single-pointedness in concentration does not mean you have the wisdom that is necessary to completely cut off the afflictions and the other obscurations. Yeah. If you're a human being and you attain serenity or the levels higher to that, if you don't dedicate properly and you get stuck in just enjoying that bliss, then you get reborn in those realms in your next life and you enjoy the bliss of the meditation. But after that, the karma for those rebirths runs out, then kerplunk, you're back in the desire realm, maybe even in the lower realms again. So they say that actually we've all been there and done that. Everything in samsara, we've all been and done before. So they say now when we have a precious human life, we should really focus on attaining liberation or awakening. Okay, so just a little bit for the retreatants, and also the people online can practice this too. When you go to bed in the evening, you might like to try this and see if it works for you. Imagine white Tara or the Buddha on your pillow and put your head in their lap and think that very gentle light is flowing into you as you go to sleep. Okay? And go to sleep with the idea of not just, oh, I'm so exhausted, thank God, I get to lie down, but, I'm going to rest my body and mind so that in the morning I'm bright and can practice well. And then when you get up in the morning, try and make your first thought as soon as you remember it. Today, as much as possible, I'm not going to harm anybody by what I do or say or even think about them. Today, as much as possible, I want to be of benefit to others in whatever big or small way I can be. And today, I will hold the bodhicitta, that altruistic intention for full awakening for the benefit of all beings. I'll hold that very dear and precious to my heart and try and increase that throughout the day. So if you start the day with that kind of motivation, then it really affects how you are during the whole day. And then, periodically through the day, come back to your motivation. Okay? Good. Then next week, we will start with lethargy and sleep and progress to agitation and regret. And then go on to doubt. Okay? So these are all things that afflict us in our meditation.